Morning, Mr. Hammond. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, involves the recovery of a stolen item designated Chimera. You may select any two team members, but it is essential that the third team member be Naya Nordorf Hall. She is a civilian and a highly capable professional thief. You have 48 hours to recruit Miss Nordorf Hall and meet me in Seville to receive your assignment. As always, should you or any member of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow all knowledge of your actions. And Mr. Hunt, the next time you go on holiday, please be good enough to let us know where you're going.
This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
If I let you know where I'm going, I won't be on holiday.
Welcome to the James Bond Complex. My name is Matt.
My name is Edgar.
And today I'll be your team leader because we're going back on a mission. Most impossible mission. More impossible than the first one. We're talking about, what am I doing, Sean Connery, all of a sudden? We're talking about Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, this is more impossible. Each one gets successively impossibler.
Until eventually he fails.
We'll get there when we get there, if we have to get there.
Yeah. So where I brought one of my favorite co-hosts, the original co-host. I brought Edgar to discuss Mission Impossible 2. Edgar, you know, do you remember? I assume you've watched the movie.
Which one is this?
It's impossible too. But do you remember your how you felt, where you were, what step of your life you were when that movie came out? Because I know it's an important summer for you. It is the summer of Gladiator.
My goodness, someone's taking notes. Yeah, that was a big summer. I know this is not the Russell Crowe detour. But yeah, no, Gladiator is a fairly momentous film in my life. I know that sounds silly, like why Gladiator and why would it be so momentous? But, you know, I guess in a very, very roundabout way, really roundabout way, I'm being generous here. But, you know, I'm doing a James Bond podcast where we talk about movies a lot of the time because of that movie, Gladiator, made by the greatest living director ever. And and then something else came out a few weeks later. I don't remember when exactly. This is 23 years ago. but
I think they came out fairly close. I think they both came out in May.
I think so, possibly. But then, yeah, this what not Gladiator. What we're talking about this morning might have been like what is it they celebrate down there? Memorial Day? No, it's not President's Day. It's Memorial Day, I think. The one in
that was actually Mission Impossible 2 came out May 24th. That's going to be some exciting live Googling.
Always great for audio.
Matt Enger.
I'll provide some atmosphere.
And that came out. What's the release date in this thing? May 1st, so it came out like a couple of weeks ahead Mission Impossible 2.
They were both making good money at the same time. But, you know, back to the heart of the subject here. I went to see Mission Impossible 2 in theaters. Tom Cruise was and still is. It's funny, we're doing this episode. I'm talking about Tom Cruise was popular back then. Guess what's coming out this summer? Mission Impossible 7 starring Tom Cruise.
Guess what was popular last summer? Top Gun 2 with Tom Cruise.
Yes. But I remember being, even in my younger days, this is 23 years ago, and I'm not that old, being kind of ambivalent about Mission Impossible 2. I had pretty positive feelings about first one, even though I probably didn't fully get it. You need to be mature to understand De Palma. I was a little bit ambivalent about this one. I think, you know, now we know what to expect from the Mission Impossibles, to say nothing of the fact that because McQuarrie with Tom Cruise has handled the last few, there's there's a level of consistency. Whereas back in the day, it was like, wait, what the hell? Why are there doves flying? And why is there so much slow motion? What's going on? And why is Limp Bizkit singing a song? You know, it was very strange. And I think that caught me off guard. What about you?
Well, I mean, I was excited because I remember this movie was promoted strongly with MTV, and they had multiple making ofs and clips. That I love the first one, so there was no way in hell I was missing that one. But when I finally saw it, and to this day, it is the last time I didn't go to theaters to watch it. I went to a drive-in theater. Oh,
nice.
And still this last time I ever went to a drive-in theater.
Oh, really?
It's unfortunate because I loved drive-in theaters, but the one in Twilight, where I used to go was closed down. Like I now feels like decades ago, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But so I was, you know, I was at the same, I was excited, but at the same time, I was so, I thought the characters in the plot relied so much on technology that seemed like sci-fi to me, like the glasses, the what is now smart glasses that he gets messages on, and I was like, "Wow, my God, are gonna tap that for Mission Impossible 3?" And no, the smart glasses became a thing, and it's not as exciting as it once was for me, but. Still, what surprised me rewatching it is those damn glasses got their own almost their own credit. They are so focused, like they have so many beauty shots of Tom Cruise just looking intensely at something while something he imagines that he's watching videos.
He's looking intensely into his future, Matt. He's looking intensely into his future. That's what Tom Cruise says.
Is golden. I think was he separating from Nicole Kidman at the time, or was he still with her? Because that's after like he had a couple of years where he wasn't working. He was making Eyes Wide Shut with Kubrick. That's why it took I think like 4 years for Mission Impossible 2 to come out.
It was a while. Well, I mean, none of the Mission Impossibles, like there's never been a quick turnaround with these movies, but
until recently, since the fourth one, they've started to come out more regularly. But
it's not
yeah,
like phenomenon.
So yeah, I was pretty excited. I'm not going to be lie. I thought it would look cool. When I first thought it was the coolest like film, even though the plot was not as rich in subplots and nuance, it's, you know, and it's John Woo is not a director I'm super familiar with. I exposed myself to more of his work recently, because I wanted, you know, that to bring sort of the authorship of the filmmaker, discuss that with you, because you've I don't know if you want to say met, but you were in the presence of Mr.
The same,
John Woo last summer.
I breathed the same air. That's John, and he was. We're recording this. There's still a little bit of snow outside, but almost a year ago, last summer, I was a correspondent for a website, it doesn't matter which, to cover a film festival in Montreal, a genre intensive film festival. And they, you know, they're big enough that they get guests every year. And a little bit to my surprise, not to poo-poo the festival, they do very good work, but I myself was a little bit surprised when the guest of honor for the event was like John Woo. Like, you mean Mission Impossible and Face Off, John Woo, and Broken
John
Arrow,
Woo?
The guy who directed Broken Arrow,
Hard Target,
and yes, that John Woo. And so he showed up to a theater, you know, Cinéma du Musée, where we hosted an evening,
lovely theater
for a Bond event, and so that's where that took place. And he was, you know, he's a bit of an elderly gentleman these days, but packed house. And I vaguely recall you know, they say, oh, it's going to last an hour, it's going to last 90 minutes. I think we were in there for over 2 hours. I mean, people just wanted to talk to him and let him talk.
I love it when the people that are presenting, you know, they're supposed to be there for an hour and they give you two. Yeah. I like, they don't have to do it. Sometimes they have time constraints and sometimes they need to close the theater, for example. But I was I'm happy that you got more of John Woo than you were expecting.
Yeah, we got a lot of John Woo, and maybe to bring it back to Mission Impossible 2, in a 2 hour conversation, you know, didn't spend 2 hours talking about this movie, but obviously it's a popular franchise. It's Tom Cruise. Like, obviously we wanted to know some information. We, the public here in the theater. And I do remember one particular story, which I thought was kind of like, it's a very nice way to handle things. They're shooting a scene, one of the action scenes, obviously. And, you know, you've now versed yourself at least a little bit in John Woo's filmography, so you have a sense for his style. It's very, this is so dramatic, and we need slow motion. We need to
subtle or clever. It's really broad strokes, but it's powerful.
Yes, and the imagery is quite iconic most of the time. And I think Tom Cruise, as I recall, you know, I'm paraphrasing a guy whose first language isn't English, who I listened to a year ago. But as I recall, you know, Tom Cruise, they got along well. He's a big Tom Cruise fan. He loves Tom Cruise. Jason, in case you're listening. John Woo loves Tom Cruise. But Tom Cruise probably wasn't accustomed to this style, like two guns. Why am I jumping all over the place? No. And there was no argument on set, but there was a bit of a conversation. And as John Woo tells the story, he said, you know, let's talk privately, you know, Tom. And so they scuttle somewhere else away from the set people and the other actors and what have you, everybody who works on a set. And, you know, Tom Cruise still doesn't really get it. John Woo's like, oh, quote, man, I'm the director, and then. And John Woo says something to the effect of, look, you know what? When we go back to our colleagues who are waiting for us to continue the shoot, let's say we both agreed on this and, you know, it was our idea. It wasn't my idea. It was our idea. And apparently Tom Cruise says, okay, I'm fine with that. So they went back out. So Tom Cruise didn't look like the complainer anymore. It was more, yeah, we negotiated. Now we agreed on this, but John Woo still got his way. John Woo also related, and I'll end with this because I don't want to hog the mic. We have an actual movie to talk about, but John Woo also related the fact that you know, this is 23 years ago. Tom Cruise wasn't the same person. He wasn't at the same stage in his life as he is today. And in Woo's opinion, in Woo's eyes, Cruise kind of looked at him like a bit of a father figure. I don't think he had, well, I shouldn't say he hadn't done a movie like this before. It's Mission Impossible 2. But, you know, it's Mission Impossible 2 has nothing to do with Mission Impossible
1.
So I think he really, I think, as I recall, John Woo's opinion was that Tom Cruise really looked up to John Woo for guidance and direction, which I thought was a nice little anecdote. So that was my afternoon last summer in the presence of John Woo. I want to be clear. I wasn't sitting next to him and I didn't interview him. I was in the same room.
you watch a Q&A from what you're describing. Yeah. But those are always great when good questions are asked. And it seemed like it was a good experience. You know, before I recording this episode, I went to you because I knew you're, you know, as a big a movie fan, a movie buff as I am, I'm friends with people that are bigger fans or fans of stuff that I am not. I'm not a big, I used to watch more foreign films when I was in my college years, but not so much now. And it's always something I'm meant to go back to. And thanks to you, I actually did, because I asked you, you know, if you, I'm doing Mission Impossible 2. We're going to be recording soon. What should I watch? Because I told you I watched Mission Impossible 2, Face Off. Broken Arrow, and I think I watched parts of Hard Target. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any of his other stuff, none of his Hong Kong stuff. And you suggested Hard Boiled. Mm-hmm. And I posted that on I think it's on my Facebook page, and people were like, oh my God, it's the best movie. And you know, the first half is like, it's kind of slow. It's kind of, but the ending, the like last 45 minutes.
It's all
minutes,
about the ending. It's all about the garage. Or is it a garage?
Yeah, the garage,
sort of a hangar, sort of, and the hospital. It's all about the hospital.
It's like Johnny said, you know what? I like that movie Tired, but I think I can make it more insane and more explosive. And that's basically the ending of that movie is Tired and bigger.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say better, but different enough. It is so much fun and exciting, and you know, it's broad strokes, but there's an element in Hard Boiled that is present in that movie. It's also in Face Off, and it's sort of it's the mirror image of, you have a policeman that goes undercover, but he's also a bad guy, but no, he's not. And you have Chow Yun Fat, who's an alcoholic and sort of careless policeman. And then in Face Off, you have John Travolta and Nick Cage switch faces, and apparently Buddy Fat too, and chest hair. And you have Mission Impossible too, where you have the character of Sean Ambrose and Ethan Hunt are sort of mirror images of each other. And I haven't looked that deeply into John Woo's biography, but it seems. I would love to talk to him about his fascination with duality and nature of good and evil, because it's something that obviously appeals to him. Because it's we have Battle of Font against what's the name of the virus? Chimera.
Isn't there a moment Anthony Hopkins shows up like twice in the movie? Why? Because they paid him, I guess. And isn't the first time when he's briefing Ethan Hunt, they're looking at a computer screen, and it's like, oh yeah, this guy's imitating you. And they like, they superimpose both faces. They look how similar they are. There's that moment in the movie. So I think they're playing that up to the hilt, to at least to an extent. Like they cast an actor, his name escapes me at the moment, but they cast an actor who sort of looks like Tom Cruise. So I guess it's easier for him
Gray Scott. You know that movie, it's a known fact. I don't know if I'm teaching you, but it more or less ruined his career or saved the X-Men franchise.
He was almost Wolverine.
And that movie, it was they shot longer than expected, and he had to bow out of X-Men, so they hired Hugh Jackman the last second to replace him. And you know, judging by his performance as an actor, you know, I haven't seen him in much.
Neither have I.
Yeah. But at the same time, I don't mind him. It's a big theatrical performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't as far as I can tell, I haven't seen Duguay Scott in anything else either. But I would say I agree with you in the sense that his acting, or the acting he's doing in this movie, like fits with what I guess John Woo would be looking for. I mean, you said it yourself, and I think correctly. You know, it's always broad brushstrokes with Woo, and this is pretty much as broad as it gets. You know, there's not a whole lot of meat to this film, apart from the fact that he and Ethan Hunt are in love with the same woman, which makes three of us, because I am too. But yeah, it's fine. It gets the job done, but I can't say he's no John Voight. Put it that way.
Yeah, that's a thing about the Mission Impossible films. It's only in the third film that they get a decent villain. And then the first two films, the villains are dissatisfied former employees.
Yeah.
I'm like, you guys need to, you know, work on your hiring department and, you know, really make sure you know they hire crazy people. He's obviously a madman. I love the scene with the there's so many scenes with that henchman that they have I won't dance around, but they have a homoerotic relationship because he's jealous of Naya because he it seems like he's jealous or he doesn't trust her. And the Gray Scott, Sean Ambrose, tells him like, yeah, I know she might be, but it's just, I'm really gagging for it. And she cuts off parts of his finger. I'm like, yeah, that you're not totally there, aren't you? You're kind of like, he plays a crazy person, but very theatrical, which fits with John Woo's aesthetic. But it's just that the difference between Mission 1 and Mission 2 is they're not made on the same continent. It's they're that different. It's just insanely weird. But you know, it's more or less what the Mission Impossible franchise was built on, because for the first four films they got a different director and a different aesthetic and a different type of storyline every time. I think it keeps the audience guessing, but recently they got the same guy back for with three, four movies. How many movies will we have done when he finishes?
Well, by the time the whole Dead Reckoning arc is done, I think it'll be four, because that's Rogue Nation. What's the other one? Fallout. And then we have two Dead Reckonings.
Dead Reckoning Part 1 and Part 2. So half of the later half of the franchise was done by one man. But I think four and five are more akin to each other than one, two, and three. You know, four is that weird middle movie right now that is a bit like the previous one, but a bit not. And I'll get there when I get there, with whomever I record that episode with. But yeah, it's they feature also a lot more of the technology. We don't see the mask building in this one, but they show that they have like chips on their throat that allows them to speak with the same speech pattern and accent as the other person, which kind of doesn't make really much sense.
I'm glad you brought up go ahead, Matt. Go ahead.
When you compare to the original TV series where you had actors who were like portraying characters, Tom Cruise just like, let's slap on a chip on my throat and I'm gonna be talking with like the Gray Scott for a second.
With an Irish accent. I'm glad you brought up the part about, because I thought about this as I rewatched the film for this episode. I'm glad you brought up the part about we never actually see any characters produce a mask. And is there any scene in Mission Impossible 2 that's more felt, the absence of the making of the mask, than as the climax is building up and Ethan Hunt is infiltrating the compound and he, you know, he butts heads with Du Gray Scott's maybe gay friend, and then he where did the masks come from? How did he know he needed a mask of the maybe gay friend to switch places? It's just like, it's Mission Impossible. There are always masks. Just go with it. It's like,
he had a backup.
It's John Woo going like, you know what? I don't care about these details. I just want masks in this movie. I've seen the show. There are masks, right? Okay, make him wear a mask.
He wears a mask on top of a mask. On his face, he has a scotch tape to keep him from talking. It's like, there's many layers of, whatever.
It's almost like, to bring it back to Bond, that moment is actually, it reminds me of an Octopussy where Bond is fleeing. Can't remember which one of the brothers is not dead there, Mishka or Grishka. And he arrives at the airbase, at the circus, and he just decides to like put on the clown makeup. But it's like only a couple minutes left before the
new blows up. It's a very complex makeup job. Yeah. I'm like, but you would barely have had the time to get yourself dressed up. I'm not even thinking about, unless they had like There's a cut scene. I don't know if you know this about a movie where like Q gives him like a makeup machine that it's more or less for ladies normally, but he hacks it and it's clown mode. And he shoves it on his face and imprints a clown face.
Do you know a lot about makeup, Mr. Bond? No, I know a little bit about women. but look, you know what I chalk that up to? Bond and Ethan Hunt are just working on different wavelengths than all of us. So I mean, whether it's makeup or impromptu masks, they can do it. I'm not worried about them.
They're over. They plan everything. There's in the previous episode I did mention that I read the synopsis. I read the novelization. There's no novelization for any of the sequel, but they do mention that Ethan Hunt, when he was graduating, I think university, he pulled a prank and impersonated the dean or something as his character. So he's always been like pulling other characters, and he's former military too, so that explains why he's so proficient with guns, because the first movie they barely use any firearm, but this one is like somebody lost the key for the gun closet and Tom Cruise found it, and wow, man,
and ammo's cheap. Oh yeah, I mean they're killing. I mean Ethan Hunt doesn't die, but he's killing people freaking left and right in this movie. It's a little bit, I like a good gunfight, especially in a John Woo movie, so I don't want to make it sound like I'm really complaining here, but in the context of a Mission Impossible film, it's a little bit like, Jesus, like people are getting slaughtered in this movie.
And thankfully, they seem to be, especially the ending, they seem to be in not really populated area. The collateral damage seems to be at a minimal, and mostly buildings or parked cars. But wow, man, they really don't care. And this, it's weird when, in the context of the film, Sean Ambrose, when early in the movie, well, I think at the halfway mark, when they do a mission, there's always a mission or a scene where Tom Cruise is suspended in the air in those movies, and he drops into the vent of not a chemical, like a biotech company, and he has like a few seconds, and Sean Ambrose explains that, you know, he won't go to the more fortified base of the building to get to where he wants. He's going to pull off some theatrics and do a crazy stunt. Like, yeah, you pretty much nailed the character. Like, it's interesting that the villain knows our hero so well, but the hero also knows Sean Ambrose, and he mocks him when he realized that he doesn't, he has the cure to the super virus, but he doesn't have the plague, because he was too careless when he pulled out his initial stunt. That's something that, you know, I enjoyed the duality here of those two villains. Now we spoke about the villains, the good guy, plenty, but there's, you know, it's a tricycle. That movie, there we're missing the and we got the two back wheels, but there's the front wheel. We haven't talked about your favorite actress of all time, Madame Tandy.
I don't know if she's my favorite actress of all time. I do think she's a good actress, and I'm more than happy to see her in any film, especially this one, or they make her up to look absolutely angelic. But yeah, I mean, this woman is this woman's drop dead gorgeous. It's funny, those early I think they're in Spain when they meet up. Are they in Spain or Portugal? I can't remember. But when they meet up and she's doing Portugal, her thieving ways. Well, it could be Portugal. And she's sort of can't remember what she's doing. She's trying to steal something. And she and Ethan Hunt meet up. Ethan Hunt is tracking her down. And I've never pinned John Woo as a sexy director. Maybe there's a movie of his I haven't seen where he shows that side. But I've seen a good number of his movies, and I've never pinned him as that. But hey, those early scenes between Madame Tandy and Monsieur Tom, there's some sizzle to them. There's some sizzle. It's good. I like it.
Definitely. I mean, you have to, no, as ridiculous, and it's broad stroke. It's not very subtle. It's very, it's broad strokes. I can't describe it better than broad stroke, because they're love affair. Like in 5 seconds, they're deeply, deeply in love, and you have to believe it. And this, I don't think that the script alone gets you there. I think it's the performance of the two actors. Like, I think I think Tandy and Tom really brought the sizzle that the script wasn't there. And I mean, you have to believe in that relationship, as ridiculous and absurd as it is, that these guys, those two people meet and they deeply fall in love in an afternoon, and they're willing to kill themselves. So
Yep.
it is absurd, but you know, it fits the tone of the movie. When I tell you about that, as I am right now, I feel like I'm a dumbass. For yeah, it's kind of dumb when you think about it, but when you're watching the movie in the context of it works.
And funnily enough, to add on to your point about how quickly it happens and in the context, I'm going to take your point about in the context of the movie it works. Now that you're a bit more versed in John Woo's aesthetic as well, I find he actually applies his action film aesthetic to build that romance, the way it's shot when they're in the tub, which also sounds ridiculous when they're in the tub together. Their playful, flirtatious, and extremely dangerous car chase. Those things are all shot in the John Woo style. So to another one of your good points, even though the script is a little bit weak with respect to the romance, and one could argue it's really weak, John, to my own surprise, John Woo's really bringing it to make this to sell this romance, and I buy it. I buy it, and I think you by the hearing your hearing you talk, it sounds like you buy it as well.
Oh, definitely. I fully hooks sink, and I don't remember how that expression goes, but I believe in the relationship. Even though the script doesn't make it so, the actors and sort of I there are parts of dialogue that I like, because often the character that Naya is meant to be sort of immoral, but realize that she is a moral character from the beginning, because at one point, like Tom Cruise and her, well, Ethan and her have a discussion about, because the mission and why she was sort of brought onto this mission was, she's the honey trap. She just meant to bang the villain and wait for him to confide in her his evil plan. More or less, that's why she's there. And Tom Cruise and her have the discussion, like, because he explained what he did, because he killed a bunch of people in a plane. Yeah, I want to talk about that also, but to in order to get a virus. And like, she's sort of she's playing as if she was morally not interested. She's not, she doesn't want to accept. But deep down, you feel like she's gonna accept, yes, but she wants a commitment from Ethan, and that, you know, she makes it clear that she cares for him, and eventually he says, yeah, I would rather, like, basically he says, I would rather you do not to do it, but I do, I it's you have to do it, because if we fail, billions of people might actually die if they're exposed to this thing. So,
There's a classic element. I mean, I'm not considering Mission Impossible 2 a classic. That's not what I'm saying, listeners. Don't email us. You can tweet at us, wink, wink. But is there's a classical element to it where all these Hollywood things where there's a great love that's crisscrossing with, but this is bigger than our love. We have to do this because it's bigger than our love. But they love each other. That's very old school Hollywood. I like it. I'm a bit of an old school film fan myself, so I kind of like it when movies do that, as cheesy as it is. And believe me, I acknowledge that there's some cheese involved, maybe a little bit of brie, a little bit of there's a lot of brie, but I still think it's Gouda when there's a romance like this. Ba-bum, boom, rim shot. Your turn.
I, you know, the best way I've heard her describe Tandy Newton, she's more like a, she would have been, if Hitchcock was still alive, I'd be over 100 years old and still making movies, she would have stuck into his world. She has an old school movie star feel about her. She has some class that, you know, some actress don't necessarily have. There's a mystery to her. There's something intangible.
She can sort of balance aloofness because she's supposed to be immoral. I don't care. So she balances aloofness with sincerity. In ways that can sometimes surprise in certain scenes in this movie. You know, I'm going to discount when she's pretending to be sick and about to jump off a cliff. I'm like, okay, I don't really care about what's going on here. But in the earlier scenes, when, I mean, for all intents and purposes, in this, the scenes she shares with Tom Cruise and the scenes she shares with Scott Dougray, specifically because she has to put on a persona in the world of the movie, I think she's quite good. You know, and this is my this is obviously very subjective, and it's what am I trying to say, it's not really fair just because I have such a little thing for Tandy Newton, or excuse me, Madame Tandy, but you know, I find it funny that they fall so madly in love and she's never heard of again. You know, I feel there's even a line in one of the Mission Impossible movies where what's his face, Luther, says like, you know, I've known the woman Ethan Hunt has loved, or something like that. And it's like, yeah, where is Tandy Newton? What's she doing these days?
Hey, maybe she's coming back for a Dead Reckoning Part 1 and Part 2 with Ethan Hunt's long-lost love child, which would make him about 20-some-odd years. Yeah. Maybe he's going to be the villain for the next one. I'm pitching ideas. if you're listening, I'm here. I can help you write these.
Tandy Newton shows up for a scene in Dead Reckoning, I mean, it's already a 10 out of 10 for me, man. I don't care what happens in that movie.
I was looking through my to the internet to see because I know the actress, but she has a Audrey Hepburn quality about her. I don't know if you who I was thinking. I was going back to Cary Grant. What's the movie that I watched? I was Googling. It's like, Charade.
Yeah, Charade. Yeah. Actually, you know what? As the British would say, I think you put the tail on the donkey. Yes. Yeah. Modern. We're talking about a movie that's over 20 years old. But yeah, she was sort of like a reimagining a reincarnation.
She's made from the same mold.
Yeah, yeah, very petite. She's like very svelte, but graceful and powerful in her gaze. That I almost forget the fact that she is so petite. I actually get a lot of strength from her. Anyways, she's an interesting actress and she has an interesting face.
Yeah, every time she shows up in a movie, she usually is a memorable, if not the best character. She shows up in one of those Riddick movies, and she's playing the equivalent of Lady Macbeth, and she's great, which makes me want to see her in actual Macbeth modern film. And she shows up for a second in the solo Star Wars movie, where she's wasted in that movie, but it was great seeing her again.
She couldn't have made an impact because I keep saying I love her so much and I don't remember her in that movie. So
blink if she dies. I think she dies in the first act. I barely remember that movie, and I think even Disney destroyed the hard drives where it was stored. Nobody remembers that movie anymore. It came out like not even 5 years ago, I think. Anyway, back to Mission Impossible 2. We talked about our hero a little bit, our villain, and the director. And I want to bring something that I snuck in earlier in the podcast. I don't know if you picked up on who's making that music for this film.
Well, we have a couple people to talk about here. Who do you want to start with?
Well, Well, obviously, it's a Zimmer score, who also did the score for Gladiator. And I found out that the lady who was doing the back vocals in is the same lady that did the back vocals for
Gerard. Lisa Gerard, I think.
Yeah, Lisa exactly. Oh, you know you know your stuff. About
the summer 2020 was spent listening to that CD, not a CD ROM, compact disc of the Gladiator soundtrack. So I heard a lot of Lisa that summer. She enchanted me.
You know what? You probably can add Mission Impossible 2 soundtrack, the score to that, if you add a playlist and just play those two scores back to back, except for the Limp Bizkit song. Well, there's a lot of cues that feel, and it's from the same artist around the same period. So you're going to have some similarities. But yeah, they're pretty, I don't see, it's like a Danny Elfman score, like Batman, Darkman, and Beetlejuice. They all sort of sound similar, but they're different. Mm-hmm. You can see that the sort of thumbprint of the artist. In that case, I don't know what's the equivalent, but you can hear the similarity in the scores. And I don't think if you were to make another Mission Impossible score today, it would sound the same, because obviously his taste and preferences have evolved. But at the time, wow, it's interesting to listen. Apart from the movie, just for ambience, as I did when I was working, I listened to the score a little bit. Listened to the Limp Bizkit song.
What do you think of the more rock infused elements of the score, because it kicks in, especially near the end, it kicks in a few times. I guess that would be Metallica doing that.
Sort of the Mission Impossible theme.
Yeah,
I know that's Limp Bizkit.
Oh, Limp Bizkit. Yeah, why did I say Metallica?
It's, whatever the space is said. Oh, there's no lyrics. The Mission Impossible song. I'm gonna put some.
Of course, as one does. what do you think of, well, maybe not the song. I didn't listen to the song. I remember there being a song, but I don't think we don't hear it in the movie, do we?
The Metallica song? Yeah. It's on the credits.
Ah, okay.
No, Old Me, Kill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me from YouTube.
Okay.
It never plays in the movie. It's only in the end credits.
But what do you think about the heavy metal infused Mission Impossible theme that kicks in a few times, like yay, nay? What are you? Because I'm still a little bit ambivalent.
I know why you want to hate me. I know what you want to hate this song.
But not the lyrics, just the music itself.
You know what? If he didn't sing, that it would be better. But is it my favorite rendition of the Mission Impossible theme? No, not by a long shot. But it's what matters is does it fit the film that it's tied to, and it does. It fits with that aesthetics, that presentation, that overly theatrical presentation of Mission Impossible, where you know the villains are the most evil. You thought John Voight as Jim Phelps was evil. You haven't met Sean Ambrose. Sean Ambrose is insane. Like not only does he doesn't care about any of the people that he injures or kills while he gets, you know, the virus. He could have gotten that thing any other way. He didn't need to. You only need to kill that scientist if you want. No, I'm going to crash a plane.
That's ridiculous.
He just enjoys being an asshole. And I love there's so many stunts, especially near the end. You know, that stunt where Tom Cruise and Doug Riscott are on motorbikes, and somehow, I don't know how, they leap into the air and collide mid jump and crash on a beach. It's awesome. It's beautiful. It's ridiculous and absurd. And you know, in reality, they would be dead. They wouldn't have survived that. But that's a violent, violent collision. Dangerous speed.
Don't the motorbikes crash into each other and explode? Or am I making that up?
Yeah, no, they do. And they tumble. And they fall not only are they high in the air, they tumble on the beach that's lower from where they are. So the really it's a big collision than a bigger fall. I did be unconscious if it was done for real, but you know, in the context of this film, where they're basically superheroes with superpowers, they're gonna have a fight.
Yeah, I felt like I'm gonna be honest. I don't really mind the fisticuffs that they engage in on the beach. I think it's decent. I don't know if it's because it's been done so often since then, and I'm not saying Mission Impossible is the first movie in Hollywood history where the main hero and villain, you know, punch it out at the end. Obviously not, but I like the way John Woo shoots it. I like the way it's choreographed. It feels like it hurts despite the sound effects there, the Foley there. That's a little bit silly, but I like the way it's shot, and I get the vibe that they're really duking it out. I kind of like that fight. I'm not saying it's great.
I'm glad you are, because I think it's great.
Wonderful. Why do you think it's so good?
Whatever. It's just the it fits with the context of the film. Again, like it's a movie. We haven't mentioned this, but this Mission Impossible 2 is the most maligned of all the Mission Impossible films. This is the one that people say, yeah, I like them, but the second one's not that good. And to those people, I'm like, and it's the same people that don't like Die Another Day.
Ironic.
You have to take the movie for what it is, and not, you know, it's so different from the first one. But that fight, those the reaction of the actors when they throw a few punches and they catch their breath because they're first exhausted and they're a little bit dizzy from the punches that they just mm-hmm. received or got gave.
Gave and received.
Yeah, it's a few. Tom punches Dougry a little bit. Dougry punches Tom, and thick back and forth. Eventually, Tom Cruise starts doing like some interesting
flips and shit.
I don't know how much stunt doubling he did, because he's not today. He's notorious for not using stunt doubles and doing all of his own stunts. But Mission Impossible 2 is probably the most heavy action movie he had ever done. Because I mean, in Top Gun, he's sitting on a fake cockpit and in the first one, he's screaming his lungs out. In The Firm, he's running. The movie with Jack Nicholson, he's running at one point, but it's a courtroom drama. He's not fighting anyone in that Kubrick movie he did. So Mission Impossible 2 is the most action he's ever done on film.
It is pretty intense. That back in the day, yeah, it was pretty intense for him.
I don't know if he was using. I know that there's a few stunts. The jumping in the from the motorbike, he did by himself. That's actually him doing that. Nice. And there's a shot with him almost getting a knife in his eye, and it's insane. I heard that, I'm like, oh my, that man, like, I had doubts about his sanity, but I think he's legit insane. There is a complex system with the knife being attached to a cable and the cable sort of going through the actor's arm, and he could only sort of stab up to like an inch, like Tom Cruise's eye. And it's basically how they did it for real, but he had a restraint. But it like he could almost like cut Tom Cruise's eyelash with that knife. That's how close they were.
Yeah, it does look really close. It's a great shot. It's a great shot. But again, that's obviously they need to prepare those stunts. The actors, the stunt people, the props people have a lot of work to do. But and I hate to sound like a broken record, but you know, it's probably the only time we're going to do a John Woo movie on this show. You know, again, that's the way it's lit, the way it's shot, the close-up, the zoom in. It's very true to his style. I mean, his stamp is all over this movie, and the knife scene is, or the knife moment is one of many, but I'm glad you brought that one up. That looks that's a badass shot. Yeah. The knife is right next to his eye.
I'm always sort of aghast when I see that. I'm like, oh, nothing with eyeballs. There's a moment in Segway that might actually cut the. In Star Trek First Contact, there's a shot with a drill that is going to go into Captain Picard's eyeball. And the drill gets close enough that it dents the eyeball. It cuts before it starts going. But it reminds me of that. It's so distracting. Both Paramount franchises, by the way.
Hey! Well.
That's no. But I'm a little disappointed they never brought Tandy Newton and her characters never mentioned again.
You're disappointed.
I think most movie fans, despite the reputation that film has, I think that character, people like that character, but they never brought her back for some reason, unless she shows up in a secret cameo in Dead Reckoning Part 1 or Part 2. I don't think we will ever see that character again, but kind of liked it. You know, speaking of Star Trek, you know, I forgot to mention that, but I should have brought it up. The story is by a pair of Star Trek Next Generation writers that I think they wrote Star Trek Generation and Star Trek First Contact, and I'm eventually going to do that Star Trek detour, I'm telling you. But it's Ronald D. Moore and Brandon Braga that wrote the story, because they were actually, you know, who was hired before they hired John Woo? They toyed with the guy who directed JFK. I have on my mind.
Oh, Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone was working on a treatment for Mission Impossible 2. And it looked, from what I've read and heard described, it was really almost like a science, even more a science fiction show, where they have a machine that could read people's thoughts. And just like, okay, no. You know, there's a level of possibility. I can believe that some high-tech company can create lifelike masks that will fool anyone. I can believe that you can find a chip that's going to amplify your voice to sound like somebody else to a certain degree. I think those are probably not possible, but just plausible enough that in the context of the film, I'll believe it. But when you have people reading mine, I'm like, okay, this actually does belong on Star Trek.
This isn't Batman Forever.
Yeah,
this is Mission Impossible.
This is a way to read men's mind. That's not new. And Tom Cruise's cousin is also one of the henchmen of the villain. I was looking at the credits, and there's an actor with the last name Mapother, and that's actually Tom Cruise's Thomas Mapother Cruise, or Thomas Cruise Mapother. He's also created a special consultant, so I guess he was probably, you know, Tom doesn't want to do this thing, so we got to figure it out some other way. He's also on Lost. He plays one of the others for the five people who still remember that show from the early 2000s. I count myself amongst them, but I don't know if you've ever watched that show, but
you're the I haven't, no surprise there, and you are the you are the king, not the prince, certainly not the court jester, far from it, but you are the king of bringing up stuff from, like, I've never heard it, and then even you follow up on your own comment with, well, for the two people who remember that.
Hey, it was super popular at the time, but now it's it has been more or less forgotten, and they didn't land the ending. It's kind of like the Game of Thrones of its time. They didn't manage to create a cohesive ending that made sense. So if you watch the entire series, you're bound to be let down. It doesn't stick the landing, basically. Unfortunate. But Mission Impossible 2, despite its flaws, I mean, it's success. It's success. It's just excessive movie. it's still somewhat entertaining. It's different from the other movies. I don't know about you, but it's I don't have the bile that some people have against this movie. Is it the best one? Probably not. Is it the worst one? I'll keep my thoughts whenever this series ends, but it's not my least favorite one. There's another movie that I enjoy less than this one.
Interesting. Don't reveal all just yet. Save it for the end, but I can't really imagine which one it would be. But anyways.
A couple of months from now, I'll tell all about it. I'm about done for Mission Impossible 2. I don't know if you want to add something that we discussed. Is there an element that I didn't bring up or you didn't bring up that you absolutely need, want to discuss?
I'm just dying to talk about that scarf that Madame Tandy wears when she goes to see Dougray Scott in that beautiful, beautiful windy shot. We need Zeritsky on that one. What's the brand? Where do you buy it? Who makes the replica? No, I'm pretty much tapped out. I will maybe just give a little bit of love to the prosthetics and the action near the end. Like the cars are flipping all over the place. Cars are blowing up. There's a bridge that blows up. The motorcycle stunt work, like they really, yes, they've done bigger and better since then, and sometimes quite emphatically. But for what it is, especially at around this era of action movie filmmaking, it is a really well put together piece of popcorn action, and I'm putting emphasis on popcorn action cinema. It's a well put together piece of work for what it is. And the last point I'll bring up is, and we'll go full circle. Matt, you started this episode by inquiring, you know, what my history with the film was and how did I feel the first time. And as I recall, I answered something to the effect of, well, I was kind of ambivalent because I wasn't really expecting what John Woo gave us. But you know, hindsight is 20/20, as the expression goes. And I think, I'll only speak for myself, but I think that Mission Impossible 2, because of its distinct voice, because of its distinct aesthetic, because we have a leading lady we never see again. And since then, there have been a couple leading ladies that have been in a few movies. I think it's a better film in hindsight. If you haven't seen it in a while, and if you poo-pooed it the first time, I'm not placing money on you're going to love it now, but I think it's better in hindsight. I think when you know what to expect and you know that it's a little bit fanciful for regards to certain details, I think it's much more easily digestible and, dare I say, fairly entertaining, as dumb as it is, which it is.
No, it's plenty of them, but you didn't mention something that you sparked something in my mind about the makeup, because the person that did some of, I don't know which shot, probably the mask reveals, was Kevin Yeager, and that's the guy who designed, who worked on the Nightmare on Elm Street. So I thought it was worth mentioning because it's Kevin Yeager. It's pretty well known. He worked on a few of the Nightmare movies, Starship Troopers, Child's Play, some of the Weird Al Yankovic music videos. Okay. But I thought it was interesting.
Oh, well, hey, anybody who can come up with what's his face, Freddy Krueger, if that guy's available, yeah, you probably want to hire him.
But you know, to bring it back to your point, it's a movie that is probably better than you remember, but there are things in that movie that they wouldn't dare do today. You'll never see another Mission Impossible movie with a virus. I think viruses in movies are done for maybe the next 50 years. That you won't hear a fanciful, because it's very fanciful with the plot. And even just the beginning, that movie came out in the summer of 2000. A year or some change later, they wouldn't dare crash a plane in a mountain. Even it actually happened a couple of years ago. Wasn't there like a pilot who was depressed and committed suicide and crashed the plane, killed everyone on board?
I don't remember that story.
I remember a story about similar to that. I'm like, no, they wouldn't. There's a lot of stuff that is fanciful and la 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 la. They treat lightly that no, not in 2023. You wouldn't. So in that degree, it's almost has a pervasive. Maybe a pervasive is too strong a word, but as a quality that. It's an element you won't see anywhere else in none of the other Mission Impossible movie, and in not in most action adventure shows or movies anymore. Viruses are not going to be it's not going to be in the next Bond movie, it's not going to be in the next Avengers movie. People are fed up with viruses as a threat.
Hopefully it's not in the next Bond movie. I mean, that's how our guy died in the last one, because of a virus or whatever.
It's not
a roboticized virus or whatever the hell.
Yeah,
nanobots.
For another talk, I just got a text message from Mr. White.
Does he like Mission Impossible movies?
It's the best one ever.
Good for you. Be honest with yourself. I like that.
So he asked us if we have people everywhere. Oh, that was a good one.
That's not bad, actually. We do have people everywhere. My name's Dougray Scott, and I play Sean Ambrose in
Mission Impossible. Keep that voice. That's not part of your voice. I'm going to be calling Sean Dougray Scott all the time.
But we do have people everywhere. Wouldn't you agree? The first thing you should know about us is Facebook. Where you can search for the James Bond Complex. What do you do on Facebook? You don't subscribe? Can you subscribe on Facebook?
You can get updates on our page if you subscribe to our page, I guess.
Subscribe.
We're bad with that social media stuff. I mean, thank God that Emery does a lot of the heavy lifting, because I'm like, oh man, no.
There's also Instagram at the James Bond Complex. That's probably the one that's most consistent.
Yeah.
Through mostly Jason, but also Emery to an extent. Of course, you can, we keep pimping the YouTube channel, even though we don't upload it very much. But there's stuff there. Search for the James Bond Complex, subscribe, and tickle us with the thumbs up button if you like the videos, of course. And of course, we are a podcast at heart. So anchor.fm puts in Quebec.
No, not anymore. It's a podcast by Spotify. They sent us a message. Apparently
they did.
Spotify podcast or whatever. Anchor is
Spotify podcast, whatever. Subscribe to the James Bond Complex. There's also Google Podcasts. Okay, so I mean, because we used to pimp Spotify, because we're there as well. So Anchor and Spotify are the same company now.
Yeah, it's called Spotify for Podcasters.
That's
what Anchor is.
Well, listen to us on Spotify for podcasters in that case. And what else? There's Google Podcasters. And of course, there's the best company in the history of all entrepreneurship in the history of mankind. Apple Podcasts. Search for the James Bond Complex. Subscribe. Write a review. Tell us which one of your action scenes in Mission Impossible 2 is your favorite, and why Mission Impossible is the best movie. EVZ. And a 5-star glowing golden gun review. But please be quick. The message will self-destruct in 5 seconds. On that note, toujours un plaisir, just as James Bond always returns. I've never said this before, and I don't know how many of these Mission Impossible episodes I'll be on, but just as James Bond returns, so will 007 and Ethan Hunt, since we're only at Mission Impossible 2, with the next mission. Missions, plural.
The next one is three, and I think Emery joins me for that one.
Interesting. Yeah, he hasn't seen it. Is that why he's doing it? I don't think he's
seen
it.
He hasn't seen anything past part two. And he's one of those people that it's my Die Another Day theory seems to be working, because he doesn't like Die Another Day and he doesn't like Mission Impossible 2. And I'm pretty sure if you were to ask Jason, he'd probably say the same thing.
Possibly, I guess so. We've never really talked about I don't know if we'd have to ask him. We DM each other every day, but if I were to wager, he probably doesn't. He's very much more in the McQuarrie camp, with reason. I mean, I think he's directed the best ones too. But I guess the nuanced answer would be, to what extent does he not like Mission? Does he hate it, or is it just like take it or leave it? I guess that's the real question.
So my name is Matt, and your name is
Ethan. Edgar.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you another time.
Ciao.
Take care.